It's the Burke Cohen Show. What is the dream? That's always the question. What is the dream of the American Republic, our democracy? Well, people largely didn't vote for Democrats in the November 2014 election. Now, what's going to happen to the party, the Democratic Party? The first guest on today's Burt Cohen Show, I'm very pleased to have Elias Isquith of Salon Magazine, who argues that it's Elizabeth Warren's party now, and that the Republican light centrists are responsible themselves for the recent losses. And in the second part of the show, Progressive Change Campaign Committee's Zaid Jilani points out that since 1848, plutocrats and slaveholders have derided every progressive reform as socialism. And that interestingly, in 2014, he says there is evidence that American public opinion is starting to warm up to the term. Well, again, Elias, thanks for being with us. And as Howard Dean noted after the drubbing, he said the Republican message was, "We're not Obama." No substance whatsoever. What was the Democrats' message? Oh, we're not either. Well, you can't win if you're afraid. Where was the Democratic Party? You got to stand for something if you're going to win. And of course, I'm reminded of a great quote by that amazing philosopher, Will Rogers, who said, "I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat." Elias Isquith is staff writer at Salon, focusing on politics. In a new article, he notes that Elizabeth Warren has ascended to Senate leadership. Now, it's unclear as to what this may mean. It seems to be an opportunity for progressives. Isquith says, quote, "If they're smart, liberals could use Warren's new power to make the changes to the party that are so badly needed." Elias, you also note realistically that in fits and starts, the party's been moving leftward for a number of years now, and I've little doubt that the midterm blowout will be cited by some as proof that Democrats must become even more centrist. Not to be cynical about the Democratic Party, but isn't it possible, Elias, that the strategy of giving Warren a prominent leadership role might be to simply throw a few crumbs to the left in order to mollify us and to shut us up while moving more to the Wall Street-dictated so-called center? What do you think?
Well, thanks for having me. You know, I think that's certainly a possibility. Part of what I was trying to argue is that even if Warren's placement in leadership was intended to sort of be a stop or just, you know, some red meat to people on the left,
right,
the fact is that she is now going to be in leadership. So for left-wing or liberal activists who have looked to her and seen in her a vehicle for moving the conversation in America, at least on economic policy, away from the right. I think it's still an opportunity that, you know, they'll need some luck and it'll take some time, but should be seized on, and hopefully can be something that when we look back, we see as an important moment in the development of the party.
And what is Elizabeth Warren's title now? What is her new position?
Oh, you know, they made up some title for her. I couldn't even tell you for sure what it is. It's something along the lines of, like, you know, leadership for strategic policy, something or other. I know that she said, people have started calling her sort of, in the media at least, not even jokingly really, that her effective title is liaison to the left.
Yeah.
And she said that she doesn't like that. She said that, you know, she understands her role as being there to shape policy and messaging around policy. And as far as she's concerned, that's what her job is.
And, you know, knowing her a little bit, I can't see her as accepting, you know, just being window dressing, you know, just a, as you say, liaison to the left. She's very, very bright, and not just in terms of policy, but in terms of politics as well. So I wonder, even if they tried to freeze her out of real policymaking power, you wonder if, quote, lefty ideologues and organizers may now have the chance to turn Warren into a kind of Trojan horse for a resurgent politics of economic populism, unquote. Now, in recent years, it seems pretty clear that the far right, the Tea Party, has owned populism. Democrats have just been run away from it completely. It seems to me economic populism has been bubbling just under the surface of the Democratic Party for over 100 years, but has yet to really surface. What do we mean by economic populism? And Elias Iskwith, why do you think now may be the time to bring it out, to bring out economic populism?
Right. So economic populism sort of this has become a bit of a catch-all term that the media is using, myself included. The way I use it, when I say it, what I'm thinking of basically is more or less what Senator Warren talks about, which is more raising taxes on very high earners, but even more than that, focusing on really regulating Wall Street, especially taking a hard look at the tax code on carried interest and sort of the regulation of derivatives. You know, as I'm sure you probably know, it's increasingly looking like a lot of the practices that created the financial crisis of 2008 are sort of coming back on Wall Street if they ever fully went away. So the issues that, you know, animated a lot of people on the left from 2008 on are still salient. But, you know, as you said, clearly the Democratic Party as of late has not been an adversary of Wall Street, yeah. Certainly not to the degree that Senator Warren and others would like. The reason that I feel like there's a good chance, well, I shouldn't say a good chance, the reason I feel like there's a chance of pushing the party is, for one thing, leadership is not in a particularly strong position right now. The president had some significant accomplishments, but I think most people would agree that his presidency, at least at this point, is looking like, in some significant ways, a disappointment. And I think that that's made a lot of the rank-and-file members of the Democratic Party a lot less interested in sort of what has typically been the Democratic Party's approach to these issues, at least since the Clintons, which is to try to conciliate and find a way we can all get along. With the Democratic Party a little bit back on its heels after the bad election in 14, the bad election in 10, and the overall lack of making good on promises from the president, I think that there's, you know, that they have a weak hand, basically. There's no doubt that they still have control over funding, and money is everything in Washington.
Right.
Which is part of why I think it's very important that people looking to use Warren and to organize around her think seriously about finding sources of fundraising and revenue that are outside of the Democratic Party's traditional purview.
I wonder if, without campaign finance reform, which appears nowhere on the horizon, I mean, it just seems worse than ever. And with campaigns getting just incredibly more and more expensive every election cycle, how can the powers that be, which have basically had tremendous influence on both parties, Republican and Democrat, I wonder how can they be taken down, their power taken down at least somewhat, because they have to have the money. I mean, if the other side is going to have all the Koch brothers money and the big oil and the big banks money, raising it, you know, by $10 and $25 increments ain't going to do it. Taking that on is quite a challenge. And is there, I mean, yeah, someday we got to have real campaign finance reform. But for the time being, is it, you know, no matter how liberal each candidate is, you know, you got to go for the money. You got to go for the money. Does this really freeze it out? Or do you think, I mean, I wonder if there's enough of a dynamic, enough of a power from the people, you know, the old populist thing, that it could really, perhaps now people are more ready to say, hey, you know, we don't want our government taken over by the special interests, by the Wall Street bankers and the oil industry. We want to take our government ourselves. It does seem to me, forgive me for going on, that the Republicans have gotten this somewhat and have tapped into the real populist anger by using the Tea Party. I mean, the Tea Party is angry at the concentration of power at government being out of, you know, the hands of the regular people. But of course, the Tea Party has been funded by those very powers. I wonder if you could speak to what I just rambled on about a little bit.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the campaign finance system is in the worst shape it's been since probably 100 years. Oh, yeah. And in the short term, I don't expect that to get better. I expect that to get worse. Mm-hmm. But what I think is important is that we keep in mind sort of the time frame we're going to have to operate with if people are going to start organizing and trying to change the party. And part of having the long view means incorporating what movements there are so far to rein in campaign finance and really regulate it. That's an issue I do some a decent amount of reporting on, and I'm not about to tell anybody that victory is right over the horizon, but I'm actually more optimistic than some might be in terms of the salience of that issue going forward. As you said, it really is something that cuts across normal partisan lines.
Yes.
When you look at polling, you see that self-described Republicans and even a good number of self-described conservatives agree with sentiments about reducing the influence of money in our political system. But what needs to be done, and what I think Senator Warren hopefully will be a part of, and so far she's always been good on these issues and well-versed on them, is figuring out ways to tie messaging around campaign finance with concrete policy changes that mean something to regular people's lives. That's what's going to be very important, and that's something that, I'm certainly not going to deny it's going to take a long time. But I think that ultimately, the Democratic Party is just a more natural home for that kind of organizing, because while certainly a lot of Democrats are relying on the 1%, members of the 1%, to naturally see the Republican Party as their home.
Right.
And I just think it's a lot harder to imagine, even with what success there's been on the Tea Party side, sort of that dynamic maintaining for too much longer.
If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest on this part of the show is Elias Isquith of Salon Magazine. And he has a new piece on Salon titled, It's Elizabeth Warren's Party Now. And that's one thing I've known since I've been affiliated with the Democratic Party, which is, 55, 60 years, something like that. There hasn't been a real definition of what the party is. A lot of people on the left kind of give up and say, oh, the Democratic Party, you know, they're just like the other party. And of course, the Democratic Party is really up for grabs. We can organize at the local level and have some real input. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren is a Democrat, and she's exceptionally popular. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is that Hillary Clinton has a lock on the 2016 Democratic Party nomination. And you say it's a lost cause. I mean, just thinking in the short term, very short term, that it's a lost cause to think liberals can force what you call Wall Street favorite Hillary Clinton to reinvent herself as a true progressive. Why is it a lost cause? Can't there be? I mean, I think it was Bob Borisage who said that politics and protest, both necessary, neither sufficient. With noise being made by the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, is it not possible to pull Hillary Clinton to the left somewhat, or why do you think it really is a lost cause? Is she that lockstep with Wall Street? My guess is probably yes.
Yeah, you know, the reason I think it's a lost cause is because I think that where we are right now for people who are on the left is we're really at the beginning of a process, not in the middle and certainly not at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that process involves having to, as I said before, sort of set up an alternative infrastructure of political power. Usually it used to be for the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as you said, that would tend to be unions. And one of the big challenges is figuring out a way to basically capitalize on what I think is a new union movement that we're seeing in a lot of the fast food strikes and take that energy and apply it and infuse it into sort of the left of the Democratic Party and to try to recreate that kind of connection between people who are, you know, the real working class and members of the intelligentsia and the political class who are sympathetic to their cause. So along those lines, the reason I'm skeptical that anything can really be done is because I don't think there is that power base yet for a left-wing challenge to Hillary Clinton. I don't doubt that if she had a challenger to her left that she would make some vague pronouncements indicating that she's willing to shift to the left one if she becomes president. What I think is a lot more questionable is whether, if and when she becomes president, people on the left really right now have leverage that force her to make good on those claims. I'm not one of those people who thinks that the president lied about his progressivism when he was running in 2008, but I think it's certainly true that in many ways the way that candidate Obama sounded, at least the progressive years, was a lot better than the way that President Obama acted. And I think, you know, as I said, to a large degree, I think that's because people within the left wing of the Democratic Party don't really have the means to pressure and force him to follow their lead. And I certainly don't think that Hillary Clinton will be any more inclined to do so, especially because she is going to be so popular on Wall Street that the amount of money she has is just going to be initially overwhelming.
Yeah, and I think in the general election, I'm not sure that'll help her all that much in reaching the people who may have been with the Tea Party, who are angry, the undecideds. Yeah, okay, she'll have a lot of money from Wall Street, but I don't know. I think my sense is that Wall Street is not all that popular these days, and it is not getting any more popular, and people are tired of them calling the shots and dictating where our party is. But we will see. Toward the end of the recent campaign, I heard people saying, well, a loss in 2014 may be better for liberals going into 2016 than a win would be. Frankly, that sounded kind of like sour grapes to me. But I do find it true, and history shows this, that defeat usually provides more useful lessons than victory if people choose to learn those lessons. Along those lines, you write that, quote, there can be long-term benefits in a short-term stint as a minority. Now, short term is between now and 2016, obviously. How do you think, what kind of long term benefits do you see from being in a short term stint as a minority, and how long term are you thinking?
Sure. Well, yeah, in terms of the benefits of just to be clear, I think they're there, but I would have preferred the Republicans not to take over the Senate.
Yeah.
In terms of my long-term goals.
Yeah.
As a person with political opinions, but where there are benefits to it is that right now, the especially in the Senate, but in the Congress too, actually, the Democratic caucuses, part of their being small, kind of a hidden virtue perhaps, is that they're much more liberal than they've been in quite some time. Obviously, it doesn't have. There's only a limited point where having a liberal minority is valuable. But what I think is important to keep in mind, and this is sort of something that I had in mind throughout writing the whole piece, is that we have a two-party system. So, and, you know, as I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the political scientists, or science rather, and it shows that, especially because our country is so divided, a lot of what happens in presidential year elections is dependent on economic factors and sort of
larger
forces that aren't completely outside of any politician's control, but are much farther removed than the kind of stuff we focus on, like messaging and so forth. So basically what I'm thinking is, if we have a rocky patch in the economy, or any kind of situation in which sentiment seems to be shifting away from whichever party happens to be in control of Congress, which would be Republicans now, towards the outside party, that outside party is going to become powerful and take control regardless of whether tons of voters are particularly enamored with its platform or the party itself. You're seeing that right now. Republicans just had a great election. The Republicans are also extremely unpopular. So what I think is important here, or valuable here, worth keeping in mind, is that if the more unified liberal bloc within the Democratic Party, which is now more powerful for the very fact that they're still in the room, is able to exert more control sort of over what the orthodoxy of the party is, that in some sense can be maybe not a shortcut, but a quicker route to a more liberal party than you might expect, because, as I said, it's a two-party system, so eventually the Democrats are going to be back in the driver's seat.
That sounds good to me. It's music to my ears. And as you write, Elias, most of the Democrats dissolved in the red tides of 10 and 14 were blue dog conservatives. And while their absence has stripped Democrats of control over Congress, it's offered lefties within their ranks the chance to redecorate, as it were, now that the majority times have ended. And on a similar optimistic note, you write, quote, "It's only a matter of time until the losers of yesterday are once again ascendant," unquote. But can this be accomplished if Democrats offer no clear identity? I mean, as Howard Dean was quoted in the beginning of this show, you know, if we're also anti-Obama as well, we need an identity. Shouldn't this moment be seen as a new opportunity for the left? I mean, I don't think Democrats have a real identity right now. And people, especially in the, you know, in the teens and in the 21st century, don't have a lot of time. And they just want to see, you know, what's your brand? They can see the Republican brand a lot more clearly than the Democratic brand. So it seems to me this moment, I mean, centrist, blue dog, conservative, so-called, you know, centrist Democrats, what the heck is that? I would think, hopefully, the party apparatus can see that, yeah, we really need to have an identity. And it wasn't it was the blue dogs that, as you say, got dissolved in the red tides of 2010 and 2014.
I agree that it is important that the party has an identity, and I agree that it right now doesn't. What I think is important to keep in mind is that the changes that have to be done in that regard might not be necessarily as dramatic as we may think, by which I mean that because the Republican Party is so ideologically and demographically homogeneous,
yes,
in some sense they're pushing anybody who doesn't fit into their demographic boxes into the Democratic Party's arms.
Not true.
The benefit of that is you have a big tent. The downside is that you can lack identity if you're just basically the not Republican Party,
right,
which is what I think the Democrats are now. The key thing, I think, as you were saying, is that if the Democrats can successfully convince voters that they are not as tied at the hip with Wall Street as Republicans, it makes a broader message of basically vaguely defined but quite popular sort of raising opportunity, expanding the middle class. That's going to resonate a lot more.
Yeah.
I think that can be enough of an identity in the current political climate, but I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah, I guess we will. And just one last thing. I know you have to run. 1964, Barry Goldwater was squashed, pounded into the sand, whatever you want to call it. He lost big time. But it seems to me, and you write about this too, that the right learned something in 1964 that the left should learn now. What might that be?
Well, you know, what happened after 64, 64 was the culmination in some ways of a process. Conservatives had been at war with sort of the moderate wing of their party from,
right,
some would say 20 years, maybe even more.
Oh, yeah.
And through just relentless organizing and capitalizing on new technologies for them, I believe it was direct mail and things along those lines that seemed sort of, certainly seemed old-fashioned to us, they were able to put themselves in a position where, even though Senator Goldwater lost, and in that sense, in the immediate aftermath, they looked like fools and failures, they were still basically holding the keys to the party by the efforts they made to successfully nominate him. So when candidate ex-Vice President Nixon is running for office in 68, it would be wrong to say conservatives had an iron lock on the party, but Nixon already had to be much more right-wing than when he ran in 1960, just for the very fact that even if these conservatives weren't representative of a lot of Americans, they controlled the party, and he had to use the party to get to the White House. It's the way the system works. So the lessons I think the left needs to learn from this is that they need to not be so focused on the next election, and they need to not take any one electoral setback as proof that their vision is going to be permanently rejected by the American people. And they should focus in some sense on an inside-outside game. The outside is having more of an identity, as we've discussed. The inside is using like-minded political figures like Senator Warren to, in some sense, infiltrate the upper chambers of the party and ideally cement themselves in positions of power there.
I always love to hear some optimism there and some learning from history. Generally, we don't do that. Thanks very much. I know you got to run. Elias Isquith, to follow him, just read Salon Magazine online. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
Wherever I go, I see people. I see you people just like me. And whatever you do, I want to do. And the blue and you and me together make free. Let's go together. Let's go together. Let's go together.
Optimism for their future. Yeah, sometimes things do get better. Sometimes they get worse before they get better. We're going to continue in a largely similar vein right now and talk about direction after the 2014 drubbing of Democrats. And our guest right now is Progressive Change Campaign Committee's Zaid Jilani, who points out that since 1848, the plutocrats of America and slaveholders have derided every progressive reform as socialism. And he says that in 2014, there is evidence that American public opinion is starting to warm up to the term. Zaid Jilani, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Bert.
Well, thanks. And he writes for a number of outlets, including Salon, The Huffington Post, The Nation. He's been following the NSA wiretapping scandal of 2013 and presented over 100,000 signatures to the U.S. Congress against government spying on American citizens. His new piece on Alternet is called Every Treasured Progressive Reform Since the Abolition of Slavery Has Been Called Socialism. And again, thanks for being with us. It seems that for practically every American, when we hear the word socialism, we stop thinking, stop listening. The people who complain the loudest about socialism really, I don't know if they know really what it is. They're just saying socialism is bad because they've heard it so much in the echo chamber of cable news and talk radio. And for a politician to be called a socialist, it's a term of major derision, usually the kiss of death. And from that moment, that person is not to be taken at all seriously once he or she has been called a socialist. But has it always been a dirty word not to be spoken of in public? Tell us about the first known use of the term as an epithet in the halls of Congress. What was the context for somebody being called a socialist in Congress?
Yeah, so that's actually a really interesting history. So basically in 1848, which actually predates the Civil War by decades, you actually had Southern members of Congress. There was a member of Congress from North Carolina who claimed that those who were advocating for the abolition of slavery were aligned with socialists. And this was an argument that was first recorded in 1848, but was definitely repeated over and over in defense of slavery. Southern members of Congress, plantation owners, advocates for slavery would say that one of the reasons that people were trying to eliminate slavery was because not only did they want to end ownership of human beings, they wanted to end ownership of big banks, of rail companies, of various other monopolies and means of production. So for these people, being an abolitionist was being a socialist. And truth be told, there were actually socialist activists who were overwhelmingly in favor of eliminating slavery, either for moral reasons or also for reasons of the fact that the South was able to use slavery to undercut labor, right? To undercut labor unions, because when you have free labor, you can just, you don't have to pay anything to. That's a great way to actually lower people's wages as well.
Sure.
There was actually some truth to people associating socialists with abolishing slavery, but like you said, it was used as an epithet. They wanted to smear abolitionists and say, well, you're not just after slavery, you're after, you know, everything. You're after all private property or after capitalism.
Well, yeah, and, you know, let's face it, when we look at the economic policies of so many of the very, very powerful, international corporations these days, they're looking to have to be able to pay the lowest wages with the fewest environmental and labor regulations, and anything that challenges that, socialism. And today in the 21st century, many on the right are quick to label anything that deals with social and economic justice as a slippery slope to socialism. Wonder about the, is it working still? The notion that, you know, it amazes me how people have called President Obama a socialist, which is, of course, is absurd because he's really a darling of Wall Street. People say that, well, I don't know how they can get away with calling him a socialist at all, quite frankly. I mean, what has he done that's even mildly socialist, or is it just because of the obvious?
I think a lot of it goes back to the history. In my piece, you know, I also talk about how basically every major reform in American life has at one point or another been called socialist, has been directly associated with socialists, meaning that socialists were the first and most outspoken advocates for those reforms, or has actually, you could argue, is a form of socialism. So not only was the abolition of slavery called socialism, but the abolition of child labor as well was right. called socialism. Members of Congress, particularly those who worked in agriculture, which is one of the biggest utilizers of child labor, said that those who were trying to eliminate child labor were trying to ingratiate socialism into the American public. In addition, the minimum wage was called socialist when Medicare was first enacted, or before Medicare was enacted. Ronald Reagan, who was just an actor at the time, he was actually employed by the American Medical Association, which opposed Medicare, he warned that, well, Medicare sounds really nice. You know, nobody opposes giving health care to people, but it's also a way to introduce statism and socialism into the American public. Social Security, the exact same thing. The AMA as well opposed Social Security. They said that it's funded by a socialistic tax. And I think, you know, probably the most recent example would be the Affordable Care Act,
right.
You know, which is primarily actually delivered through private insurance companies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, through market exchanges, right? You know, not terribly socialist. but it was all, it's also been decried as socialism, as big government, as, you know, as an attack on free enterprise. So I think what we're seeing now is that we have a generation of people, probably, you know, my generation, a little bit younger than that, who didn't grow up during the Cold War, who are learning that a lot of the things that we actually really like have been called socialist or associated with socialism. And I think that we're actually seeing sort of a cooling off of the term. You know, the term is becoming less useful as a smear. And I think that a lot of people in younger generations are starting to say, well, maybe there are some useful things we can learn from socialism. Maybe there are some useful programs we can implement. Maybe we can have an economy that's more of a mix of socialism with our capitalism and our free enterprise.
Yeah, interesting. If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest in this half hour is Zay Jilani, a campaigner for Progressive Change Campaign Committee. We're talking about the boogeyman socialism. And I wonder, I'm starting to get the sense, the right has long defined the struggle as between, on one hand, free enterprise, good old American, rugged individualism on one hand, which justifies every abuse of moneyed power. And, you know, there's virtually no controls whatsoever on pollution, on fairness of taxes that super rich people pay. And it's either that or socialism. And for a long time, people in what used to be the middle class have kind of instantly, instinctively reacted and said, oh, yeah, we got to protect the free market and free enterprise and individualism because socialism hurts me. I'm starting to get a sense that people, you know, with the whole Occupy Wall Street with the 99%, people got that. People really understood that. And if they accomplished nothing else, just putting that 99% versus 1% in the American understanding, I think was a significant victory. So, you know, I wonder if maybe now is a time where people are, especially younger people, might be willing to listen to the term socialism and not be like instantly freaked out about it. And regarding social issues like marriage equality, reproductive rights, and legalizing cannabis, there's clearly a break among generations. Millennials are fine with these issues, and they seem to be fading as rallying points for the Republicans as well. Do you see, Zaid, a generational difference when it comes to the use of the word socialist? As you say, you know, the millennials, the people who are like in their 20s and early 30s now, I think, didn't grow up with the same fear of, you know, the godless communist Soviets coming down on us and maybe more willing to listen to the word socialist. Is there, do you see evidence that there's that generational difference?
Yeah, so Pew actually did polling on the topic, and they found that about 2-1, Americans still have sort of a negative view of socialism, but once they look just at the age group of people between the ages of 18 to 29, what they found was actually more young people have a more positive view of socialism than they do of capitalism. A plurality had a positive view of socialism. I think it was something like 48%, 47%. And that was kind of a remarkable turnaround from 2-1 against, which was sort of the American public as a whole. You know, there's probably a number of explanations for this. I think one is the fact that young people aren't living in a Cold War sort of mentality and a Cold War narrative. But also, I think young people are facing much more difficult times than their parents were. Student debt is a real issue now when it was almost a non-issue for the generation before for the particularly between the 50s and 80s. Medical costs today are much greater than they ever were. Basic cost of living, I mean, rent, groceries, you know, everything basically that's essential to living a good life is now inflation-adjusted and cost-of-living-adjusted more expensive for young people growing up. You don't have assets. You don't have a nest egg. You don't have homes. So I think the appeal of trying something different is higher for anyone that when what they have been doing isn't working out. So I think there are a number of explanations for it. But, yeah, I do think there is some real evidence that young people are starting to look into these ideas. And it may generate enthusiasm for whole different sorts of policies.
Interesting. And, you know, I sense that many more Americans are recognizing now that the problems that we're facing with government and the economy are structural problems and not merely cyclical, that maybe more and more people are ready to say, you know, having the 1% calling all the shots, having them own government isn't so good. But if Democrats don't take this opportunity and talk about, you know, the real structural change, I don't know if Democrats will, you know, without an identity of taking this power structure on, the structural problems, if Democrats can expect to be doing any better. Do you think it's necessary for Democrats? And do you see any Democrats talking about, you know, moving to the traditional left at all? Or are they still just, you know, too sheepish on this?
I mean, I think that the there's no sort of one right answer to the question, because I think the Democratic Party is, you know, big, it's diverse. It certainly behaves in different ways in different elections in different parts of the country. But I do think the fact that, for example, Senator Elizabeth Warren,
yes,
is polled to be among the most popular, not only all Democrats, but all I think she's talking about, which is an America that's become extremely unfair for people at a structural level, not just a matter of one policy or one president, but at a structural level, has become supremely unfair. I think the fact that's resonating with people is very important.
Yeah.
I think the fact that Senator Bernie Sanders, who isn't, yes, a Democrat, he caucuses with them, but he's an independent, is seriously considering a presidential candidate is getting actually a fair amount of enthusiasm and respect from the mainstream media.
Yes.
Shows that I think that the old sort of ideas that we all had in our heads about the economy were about how something's life, you know, we can't do anything to change them, and how things really aren't that bad, and those old ideas are going to be washed away, and that we are actually seeing, even as the economy does recover, as joblessness goes down and unemployment down, we're seeing very strong themes of, you know, what is a just economy and what is a country where everyone can get by continuing to stay here, which is actually kind of unusual in recent political history. I mean, in the 1990s, after we had a jobs boom, no one was talking about inequality, right? Bill Clinton brought unemployment way down, and he created a lot of jobs, but inequality was still soaring. Now, joblessness is actually declining, and we will go back to a full economy over the next few years. I think this theme of inequality remains, because right now we have a very focused sort of movement of people, you know, from the Warrens and the Sanders down to the grassroots level, are people who are really looking at these issues, as you said, at a more structural sort of point of view. You know, at a point of view that says, you know, yes, the economy goes up and down, but whether it's up or down, it's still very unfair for us. And there's still people who are getting up fantastically,
yes,
well,
yes,
much more than they ever have before, yes, while the vast majority of us aren't seeing our position very much.
Yeah, the middle class has been largely wiped out. And oftentimes, throughout the 20th century, mainstream politicians have painted fairly successfully socialism as un-American. Well, if you look at the history of the United States, it seems to me there's a long thread that has been there. It's part of our American tradition. For example, Upton Sinclair famously wrote The Jungle, which every school kid has read, ran as a socialist for governor of California in 1934, and probably would have won had it not been for a brand new phenomenon of corporate advertising against him. And in 1912, Eugene Debs ran for president and garnered the highest number of votes for a Socialist Party presidential candidate in the U.S. Before that, even way back in the 1770s, you know, were the rebellions, the Shays Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellions, which sought to make federal government work for the debtors, for the working people, and not just the aristocratic creditors. So, you know, my point is that socialist tendencies have a long, deeply rooted tradition in American history. Zaid, do you have any reason to think that American public opinion, it sounds like we are starting to warm up the terms to that term. Might things be changing relative to the instant reaction to the word socialist?
You know, there was an interesting sort of body of research on anybody, right? You know, talking about certain things gives people anxiety, right? So, for example, if someone has PTSD, you know, bringing up a certain subject that relates to their PTSD might create a lot of anxiety for them. So when you apply that to politics, I think socialism as a term created a lot of anxiety, particularly during the Cold War, because it was very easy to associate with the Soviet Union, like you said, godless communists, so on and so forth. But there also becomes a time when you use a term so often, people actually begin to start adjusting to it. And it starts becoming from something that may have been very distressing to them to maybe slightly annoying to them to, you know, maybe there is something to this, right? So I think that may be actually what's happening to the term socialism right now. I think that the people who have opposed every progressive reform this country has ever had have maybe overplayed their hands a little bit.
Interesting.
Calling everything socialist, particularly things that people really like Medicare, Social Security, child labor laws, the minimum wage, a number of other things. So I think that, you know, we are seeing a real sort of shift in how Americans view this simply by the fact that there is a point where you can simply play a card too many times. I think it has been played far too interesting national debate on this if, you know, the one politician in our Congress who actually openly telling the socialists where to run. You know, it would be great to see him from across the country, everywhere from South Carolina to Iowa to the coast of California and Oregon, and saying that, hey, I'm a socialist, and all that means is that I believe everyone should get a fair shot and that we should have some things that should just be available for everyone, like healthcare and education, because that's how you have a great society. And I think that would be a very interesting and important debate to have, and that's one reason why I would definitely advocate for him running, regardless whether he wins or not. I think it's an important thing to say to do.
And I do believe, I mean, the show comes from New Hampshire, and Bernie Sanders has, amazingly enough, been in New Hampshire quite a bit lately. I don't think it's a coincidence. In all seriousness, I do get the sense that he is going to run for president as a Democrat, because he recognizes, I mean, he's a very bright guy. He recognizes what Nader did in the year 2000 when he personally elected George W. Bush. So I do believe he's going to do that. And he's been down south. He's been to places like Alabama, where somebody like Hillary Clinton, you know, some perceived centrist and, you know, happy to be a tool of Wall Street candidate, ain't going to cut it. But he's connected with people down in places like, as I said, Alabama. And I'm imagining the dynamic of a serious candidate embracing the term. And the media, they love something new. Politics is so much theater. It's all about theater that, you know, they just go along with whoever is the front runner at the time. Can you get a sense of what a serious run by Bernie Sanders is going to look like when it comes to reaching people who don't? I mean, a lot of people stayed home in 2010 and 2014 because they weren't motivated. There was nothing like, I don't connect with this person. You know, they're just like the other guys. Maybe they're a little bit less bad. But what's your sense of how the media might play with Bernie Sanders? And also, as part of that question, most of the time when I tell people, yeah, I like Bernie Sanders, I think he's going to be a really strong candidate, they say, oh, but he's a socialist, and they're not going to listen. It's got to break through somehow that barrier of the word socialist. How do you picture his campaign going? Of course, there's always something unexpected, but what do you think, Zaid?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we're more than a year out to the first Democratic primaries, if that's what he chooses to do. So it is sort of difficult to call. As you say, a lot of things change in elections. But I do think that there's something really interesting that, you know, I'll see him go on television or I'll see him go on a radio show, and he will get some of that banter of, oh, you're a socialist, you're a long shot, so on and so forth. But on the other hand, I think we've seen some serious, real engagement with his ideas. Simply because he's been on the right side of so many issues, and he's been able to take on tough issues like, for example, the Bush tax cuts, the crisis at the VA, resisting cuts to Social Security, things that actually made him a lot of allies and actually gained him some respect as a senator. And I think he's been able to leverage those things to create some credibility for himself. And, you know, there's also just the fact on the Democratic side, it's pretty clear, other than possibly Miss Clinton running, there isn't really that much there. And the media does like a fight.
Yes.
And if it's him and Hillary, it is going to be an interesting fight, and he will get a lot of press out of that.
Yeah.
And I think what's really crucial to see how that goes is to see how he is able to represent the message that actually his values, which he calls democratic socialism, are the values of the same things that all Americans love. You know, we all love great schools for our kids.
Yes.
We all love the idea that no one's going to go and die on the street because they don't have health care. We all love the idea that everyone who works hard is going to be able to be out of poverty, living wages, right? So I think a lot of it's on him, on his ability to associate his values with really what really are American values, if you really think about it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we all really value public education and clean drinking water and clean air. These are health issues, not just, you know, some, you know, well-to-do tree huggers. These are issues that people really care about. And I don't see, you know, mainstream Democrats jumping on this. They play nice with the Republicans. Instead of calling them what they are, which is extreme right wing, they just sort of, yeah, we're kind of like Republicans, too. I don't see that as a winning strategy. I just don't see it. We got to be really different, and I think it's possible that a more aggressive, muscular, left-leaning Democratic candidate might have more appeal than weak-kneed centrism. But again, most Democrats, even, you know, pretty liberal Democrats, they'll run as fast as they can from the term socialism. But again, as we said, theater. The media loves theater. And if Bernie Sanders is saying, yeah, I'm an independent socialist, so what? Listen to what it is. It might possibly have the chance of breaking through. Any sense on what people can do to, you know, if they're not freaked out by the term socialism, how can people get involved and help push this? Letters to the editors or... you know, what do you think people can do? I always like to try to empower listeners to the Burt Cohen Show. Any suggestions, Zaid Jilani?
You know, it's interesting. I think the transformations that happen in American society on some of the many issues you were talking about earlier, you know, women's rights, gay rights, things like that, you know, a lot of them are just a matter of people saying, yeah, I believe in this idea. It's a good idea. It's not that scary. Let me talk to you about it. And I think that's what people have to do with things like socialism.
Yeah.
You know, if they're listening to the show and they have their monthly Social Security check,
right,
you know, and they're talking to their neighbor about it, just say, you know, this was called socialism when they started it, and I really like it, and it worked really well. And, you know, if we're going to have more things that are called socialism and they work this well, I'm for them too, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that instead of people have to be like Bernie Sanders, just be proud of talking about it this way. And that's how you open people's minds. And I do think we're at a moment in American history where we are like the early 20th century with Eugene Sinclair being more open to changing our economic way of life, changing our system. And, you know, these moments come and go. So I think, yeah, anyone who sees that change should speak up for it. Just talk about it. Just let the anxiety pass for people.
Yeah.
The more we talk about it, the more open people will get to it.
Yeah, and I've seen that actually start to happen. And, you know, we think all the power is with the 1%. That is not true. It really isn't true. The people talking, you know, just, you know, word of mouth really does matter. It absolutely does matter in making these changes. I mean, you know, we're not a plutocracy completely yet. And one thing that stops us from being a total plutocracy or oligarchy is people speaking and talking about other ideas. Well, thanks for being with us. If people are interested in following your other work, is there a website you can point them to?
You know, one of the best ways, actually, just follow me on Twitter. It's at and then my name, so ZAIDJILANI, because I usually post everything on there, so
all right.
Links.
Well, thanks very much. It's been a very stimulating, thought-provoking, and even optimistic, dare I say, discussion. Thanks very much, Zaid Jilani, for being with us.
Yeah, thanks.
And thank you for listening. Love to hear from you. Email me, bert@bertcohen.com. Thanks again.
I'm afraid, I said.
Come anyway,
she said. And I did, and I flew. I didn't fall as I expected to.
We flew through the air,
her and I, everywhere,
to the sky. On the threshold of fire, the dawn of the century.
I dare you to care.
I dare you to risk your life.
I dare you to believe in all the things that you learned in childhood that were right.
I dare you to believe.
I dare you to care.
To me,
we crossed the river and found a few.
Yeah, those are dragons, all right.
Said she,
I know a place where you can go, where only children can be. It's a place of imagination, of sun and sky and sea. On the threshold of fire. The dawn of the 21st century. Let's go
all the way.
Let's go
twice as fast.
Let's burn
twice as brightly. Sounds like a love song. To the edge,
to the pale,
to the pale.